This is the final installment in the Moon is an Orange Triangle trilogy, a series which looks at families who live positively with autism. The first series looked at children, the second, teenagers, and this is part one of a three-part series which looks at adults. The Moon is an Orange Triangle, Series 3, Episode 1, directed by Alison Toomey.
My name is Joanne Weller. I am 21 years of age and I have autism, as I also have a mild stroke, moderate learning disability. When I was 15, my parents explained to me what autism was, as I would not have understood it up to that point. Every day I face different challenges. I have problems coping with my feelings. I do not understand some of the feelings that I have, and because I do not understand, I cannot explain this to anyone. When I try to talk to people, they do not listen to me or dismiss what I'm saying, and that hurts me even more. I have been called weird, a freak, and the most hurtful of all names that I have been called is the R word. What is the R word, you may ask? It's a retard. I think people think I am a bad person. People see my disability, not me as a person or my abilities. The use of language is so important. My parents used to say to me, "Oh, it's up in Nelly's room behind the wallpaper." I did not understand what this meant. I do not know any Nelly. I do not understand what sarcasm is, even though my parents tried to teach me. I can still be gullible. I do take things literally. To me, the world is black and white and there is no grey. Day-to-day living can be hard sometimes. I like routine and knowing what is going to happen for the next week, the next month, and yes, even the next year. I have difficulty with doing some everyday things that people do. At present, I am learning life skills. This means how to look after my home with help from my mother and Gail. I have to be able to shop, cook, keep the house tidy, keep my clothes cleaned and ironed. Our family never owned a car, so we always travel on public transport. Over the years, I learned how to read timetables and now I can travel independently. Most of the time, I feel that I do not understand the world. I feel a distance between me and what is going on in the world around me. I just want to scream and shout to the world about what I'm truly feeling right now. I want the world to listen to me like they do with everyone else. But instead, I keep it in and let it all out when I get home. I do not understand some of the social cues that other people take for granted. I had a breakdown and I attended a therapist on a regular basis. With their help, I am slowly starting to learn how to be able to cope. My goals for the future include trying to get higher qualifications as a table official for basketball. At the moment, I do this on a regular basis and it is something that I really enjoy. I also want to be able to live on my own. And I also want to feel I belong to the world. But every time I try, it just doesn't work. I also want people to accept me for who I am and not take me for granted. Since I become a member of As I Am, I feel I truly belong for the first time. I can be me, Joanne Weller, and I do not have to hide.
In this series, I spent time with three main characters. Later in the programme, you will get to meet John and Norma Finn and their severely autistic son, Martin. And I travelled to Cork to spend time with Stuart Nielsen, who was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome in 2009 at the age of 45. But first, here is Adam Harris, a young man with Asperger's, who founded the organisation As I Am. And I caught up with Adam at their first ever conference.
Good morning. And welcome to the As I Am National Autism Conference. We're delighted to be welcoming all of you here this morning. And I think it's a little bit weird even saying that welcome to the As I Am National Autism Conference, because certainly when we started 3 years ago in the basement of the International Bar on Wicklow Street, we didn't think we'd be saying that here today. But I suppose the reason we are saying it is because of the amazing support that we've received from the autism community over the last 3 years. And it's been an absolute privilege for us to have the opportunity every single week to travel right around Ireland and visit schools and visit workplaces and visit community organisations and meet with people on the ground. But what's really special about this morning is it's an opportunity for us for the first time ever to bring everyone under one roof. People with autism, family members, professionals, to work together, to have a conversation together, to support one another, to share experiences, and also to celebrate the fantastic community that is really the backbone of autism in Ireland. And the other thing is, let's make sure today that we don't leave this important conversation in the room. Let's have a great conversation in the room, but let's make sure it gets out there as well. And let's make sure it reaches the people we need to send this important message of inclusion to. It was a big challenge for us when we decided to run a national autism conference as to what topic are we actually going to discuss, because there were so many different options that we had. But one of the things about As I Am is we really try and be inclusive of what is a very large and diverse community made up of different age groups, of different needs, of different interests. And it was very difficult to try and capture that in just one topic. But really, what we went back to in the end was realising what As I Am was all about, which was the individual, and meeting that individual where they're at, and giving the person the skills and the tools that that person needs to reach their own personal potential and to have an opportunity to be understood within society. So really, all that's left for me to do at this stage is it's my honour to introduce our MC for the day, Gary Cooper, who'll be your MC, and to hand him over to begin the proceedings of the conference. So thank you very much.
I have to stress again what Adam has been saying, that this is an autism-friendly conference. And if I could just take you over a few of the points very briefly, please. I suppose the key issue here is mutual respect, and it's mutual respect for everyone's comfort. So if people need to get up and move around, that's fine. There isn't a problem with that. Avoid strong perfumes and colognes. I've been told that everyone has been asked to use their indoor voice. If you're in my house, which is, yes, dear. So I'm going around saying yes. As far as communication is concerned, I think it's worth remembering that communication is not always about talking. You've already been sent a colour code system here that you will see some people using. A red sticker basically means I prefer not to talk to anyone just at the moment. Okay. Gold, I'm happy to talk, but maybe only with those I'm familiar with. And thirdly, the green sticker, I'm happy to talk to anyone. So just please do bear that in mind, and please do ask or offer to help if necessary. And linked to that, could I also suggest that at the end of each speaker, we don't use the traditional applause. And finally, before I sit down, I have to say, as I said at the outset, it is a huge pleasure for me to be here today. And when I was looking through the material that I was sent about the conference, I was greatly struck by the title, Empowering Potential. The word power is in there, and I think that is so relevant. It's so relevant to people with autism, but it's also so relevant to their parents, their families, their carers, and their educators, anyone who is involved with young people.
So Adam, how's it going?
Well, I think I'm not really sure at this stage, but it seems to be good. It's nice to just have the whole thing underway, which is positive.
You can take a little breather now. You've been mad busy all morning.
Exactly, and you know, until it starts, you just never know what's going to happen. So it's an anxious time, but no, people seem to really be enjoying themselves. We're trending on Twitter, that's good. So the 6-1 News have just left, and we've the Irish Times here, so we seem to be getting a good bit of coverage. I suppose having a good event is one thing. Getting the conversation beyond the event is obviously the purpose of the event as well. So to see that's very positive. So I'd be keeping an eye out for a minute past 6 to watch that tonight now.
Yeah, and you're absolutely beaming. This is a huge achievement for you, isn't it?
Yeah, and for my team. I mean, my team did a lot of very heavy lifting on this. So Gwanya Lynch, our community manager, is also an autism parent. And Katie Quinn, our programmes manager. You know, it's been very much a team effort. You wouldn't let me tune in the logistics or something like this. So we'd still be untangling badges or something. But no, it's a great achievement for the organisation, and we're very proud of it. And hopefully it's just a starting point. I mean, again, it's not just about having a lovely event. It's really a rallying call for the movement. And that's something that we're very excited about.
Mary, you're Adam's mum.
I am.
Are you very proud of him today?
I'm extremely proud of Adam. Yeah, yeah. I'm always proud of him, but I'm really proud of him today. Yeah.
It's a big day. It's a massive achievement, isn't it?
It is. I mean, for the first conference, like, to get so many people to it, and a waiting list as well, like, it's more than we would have hoped
fantastic.
For.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
So when Adam was first diagnosed, that little boy that you were trying to figure out, as I can imagine, all these years ago.
A nightmare of a boy.
A little nightmare. He's laughing. He looks so nice and placid now.
Oh, he's lovely and placid, aren't you, Adam?
Would you have foreseen this at all today?
Definitely not. I always knew Adam had great potential, but no, I never seen it going anywhere like this far. No, I really didn't.
So how did Adam get to here? What do you attribute it to?
Early intervention, definitely one thing. And then I think he was very much challenged all the time. We very much challenged and pushed the boundaries with him, because I always told him that the world wasn't going to change, that he had to try and change to and meet it halfway.
Good advice.
And he didn't go into mainstream until he was about 7, going on 8, I think. And so he had to learn the social skills that come naturally to other children. So there's a huge emphasis for 3 years on that. So I definitely think that played a huge part. And then Adam has something in him too. He always has this passion for making a difference and changing things. And I think, you know, I want to help other people.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think,
but once you had the supports in place for Adam, he could just explore his potential.
Exactly, yeah. Once we got into the right education system and that kind of thing,
So Adam went to mainstream school?
When he was in second class. Mm-hmm. He was in special ed up to that.
Okay.
With a fantastic SNA who's here today, actually, and I attribute an awful lot to her being there for me, because she was fantastic.
So what was he like as a child? You say he was a nightmare.
An absolute demon child.
Really?
He couldn't let his hand go. He had no sense of danger whatsoever. He would be out the door like a shot if he could. He had to play everything by Adam's rules. He controlled everything. He didn't sleep till he was over 7. He took
That's
everything
tough.
Literally. He was an absolute nightmare.
Really?
Yeah,
that's,
I mean, the whole house revolved around him. His oversensitivity to smells, I mean, controlled what we ate. Mm. We couldn't go out to eat anything like that. We would freak out. I mean, it's just so unbelievable when you look at him now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean, he has come such a long way.
And Adam is 20 now.
21.
So when he was diagnosed, did you know what autism was?
Well, to me, autism was someone really that was non-verbal for a start. And Adam spoke at a year old. He said sentences and things like that. But his behaviour was dreadful. And I knew, even if we took a different route to the supermarket, he'd go absolutely ballistic in the car.
Yeah.
And I'd had two other children, and I was a Montessori teacher, so I worked with kids. So I knew there was something different about him.
Right.
I always knew it. Yeah. I couldn't put him down out of my arms. Quite literally, he was reared on my hip till he was about 5. Yeah. So I just knew this wasn't atypical behaviour.
Yeah. And what was your reaction when you brought him, when he was diagnosed? What was your reaction to that?
I think it was a relief, really, because, I mean, I knew, and it had sort of explained it, you know. So I didn't kind of have that shock thing that people talk about. No, it was a relief. There was a reason for it, you know. It wasn't just a poor little brat.
And then you just got busy finding out, right, how do I deal with this, how do I cope?
Yeah,
this?
I knew I didn't want to put him into mainstream and for him to be labelled boy boy, because I knew that's what would happen, so I was determined not to. So we put him into the first preschool that opened in Ireland, actually, for children on the spectrum, in Ballyboden, and I used to drive over there every day, wait outside for 2 hours and drive home again, because it wasn't worth coming home and going back again. And then he went automatically from there. He definitely wasn't ready to go into mainstream. He wouldn't have sat still. I mean, he would have caused havoc. So he went from there to Beach Park, which was a fantastic experience. And then they decided he was ready to integrate back in. They would try it. And great support was set in place for his buddy systems and visiting the school. And it was all done quite gradually. And he went to Patrick's and Greystones, which was terrific. I have to say, they were very, very open. I mean, they were just wonderful.
It's a very positive story, isn't it?
When you hear other people don't have maybe such good experiences, Adam didn't have a bad experience, and I say we got the services, I think, pretty easy.
Is it down to luck or research?
I don't know, maybe it's down to luck, and I think the fact too, they thought Adam is very dyspraxic, so his balance was off, so they thought maybe he had a brain tumour, actually, they actually thought originally, and then they thought maybe cerebral palsy, so a lot, he went to see a neurologist, and when he ruled out all those things, he had intensive physiotherapy and occupational therapy for Adam, so he used to go for sessions every day for, say, 3 or 4 weeks in Temple Street, in a block, then break for 2 weeks, and then go again, so he actually had a lot of very intensive stuff, which we were very lucky to access, and I think it just happened by chance, you know? I really think so.
Yeah. So Adam still lives at home?
He does.
So what's life like at home with Adam?
Still a bit chaotic. And Adam's still a bit all over the place. His organisational skills are atrocious. But most of the time, he's great. He's
you
great
wouldn't
to be
think
around.
Today now that his organisational skills were atrocious, his organisational skills?
Absolutely. dreadful.
Wow. Dreadful. How did he pull this off?
He loses everything. I mean, he has great ideas all up in his head, but he would find it hard to bring things together.
Pin them down.
Yeah, definitely. That's where he would still need the support. Like, I was packing his bag in the room this morning in the hotel saying, how did he ever travel on his own? And he does. No bother to him. I don't know how he does it. He loses half his belongings on the way, but he does it. He does.
What about relationships? How's your relationship with Adam now and your husband and the rest of the family? Well, how's the whole family as a unit?
Great. Everyone absolutely idolized Adam.
Yeah. I can see why.
He has a very likability. He's very warm, caring.
Very charming.
Yeah,
man.
He is. Yeah. No, he's an absolute treasure. He really is. I think we all think that at home.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah. No,
that's
we adore him. We really do. We adore him.
Nice. Yeah. And what about relationship? Has he had a girlfriend or do you ever think about that?
He has had a girlfriend in the past. Yeah, he has. He's not in any relationship at the moment.
That's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, he's quite happy though. Yeah, he's quite happy though. Just being him. She said he's too busy anyway.
It's too busy to bother with a girl.
Yeah.
Because I suppose as a parent, you do think, or sometimes you think into the future about family and relationships and grandkids. And is it hard? Do you think about that? Is it hard to think about?
No, I actually don't really think that far ahead. No, I don't. No, I just kind of take it as it comes. No.
Yeah.
No, I don't really think about that. I just think what will happen.
Yeah, that's a good way.
Yeah, I don't think about that. Yeah, I'm one of those people that very much lives in the moment. Yeah. I think Adam's taught me that too.
Here we go.
I'd love you to take me just right back to the very beginning. You're from Ireland.
Yes, I'm from Listunvanna, County Clare.
It's a lovely part of the world, John.
Well, it is quite nice.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And why did you leave? When did you leave Listunvanna?
I left Listunvanna in 1972. And I went to Manchester and I worked there for a couple of years and I come back home and I decided to go back again. So I'm practically in Manchester since the early 70s.
And you've been living in Manchester ever since?
I have, yeah.
What did you work at? Did you get a job straight away?
Yeah, I got a job straight away. I worked in the building. Well, I'd always kind of, from the time I'd left school, I'd worked in the building side. So there was, like I say, there was a lot more of it going on in Manchester than there was in the west of Ireland.
Yeah. So were you a builder all your life?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when did you retire?
Well, I've retired for a few years now because of our son, Matt. He's got severe autism, so...
So did that bring an early retirement
for
you?
Well, it did, really, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a job for two, really, you know. So.
It's a job for two, you and Norma.
Yeah.
So Norma is from Manchester.
That's correct.
You're an Irish man, she's an English lady.
That's right.
So when did you meet Norma?
Well, she had a lot of Irish connections, really, so she really liked Irish music and I met her in an Irish club.
Did you? Go ahead, that.
She's quite good at dancing as well, so and she liked music, so.
Is she still good at dancing?
She is, yeah.
Yeah? Are you any good at dancing?
No, not too bad.
And you have an older daughter as well.
That's right.
There's two.
Maria.
Maria.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what age is Maria?
Maria's 45.
45?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Martin is 20?
Martin is 25 this June.
So Martin's 25
yeah.
this June, coming on his 25th birthday.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to bring us right the way back then, John, when Martin was born, perfect baby, he didn't notice anything was wrong at all.
No, actually, he was when he was born, everything was perfect up to about the age of two.
Mm.
And then he started like with ear infections and he wasn't talking. So it was from the medical profession, kind of thought it could be to his ears that was because he was slow at talking.
Mm. So they thought he had an inner ear problem or something?
Yeah, he had grommets done. He had that them done a couple of times. So then obviously they realised at between two and three that he had got some form of autism.
Right.
And it could start it off that it might be just a mild form.
Yeah.
And then moderate. And then as he got older, obviously it was severe to very severe.
Yeah, so that's where he would sit on the spectrum now, severe to very severe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you were given the diagnosis of autism for your son Martin, did you know what autism was?
Not a lot, really, to be honest. We didn't know, very little about it at that time.
Not a lot of people did, though, did they? Nearly 25 years. Well, 22 years ago.
Yeah.
So did you have to, and of course, you wouldn't have had the internet to Google it or look it up. So what did you do?
Well, we kind of, you know, we talked to as many people as possible, and teachers and people that have worked with autistic people. But having said that, it was very hard to get information, really.
Yeah. And still all the time you're at home with this little boy who is, you know, acting out, acting differently, and you didn't know how to deal with him. So what was the situation at home then when he was three? Well,
the situation, I mean, a lot of what we'd be told is probably as he gets older, things will get much better. Mm. And he'll be, you know, able to cope with different situations. But you kind of hope that that is going to happen as he gets older.
Yeah. So you were hoping for that for a long time, probably. And when did you realise, okay, I think this is how Martin can live?
Well, we realised, I suppose, really, when Martin reached the age of 12, maybe 10, 12, 14, that obviously that he's living in a very complicated world, really.
Yeah.
And he's seeing things completely different to what we're seeing, you know.
Yeah.
Never, never,
here we go. Martin had spent the morning avoiding me, so John went to look after him so that his wife Norma could come and join me for a chat.
He'd a lot of little problems, you know. He couldn't communicate with him, or, you know, you still can't really communicate that much. You know, if he wants a drink, he's familiar, only with familiar things now. You know, if he wants a drink and he knows what he wants, and he can go to the fridge and, do you know?
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah.
There's not much you can communicate with him, really, only by knowing what he wants and what he likes.
Right. So you've it figured out by now, though, because he's 25 in June, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
So school then, I mean, did he go to preschool or play school or Montessori?
Well, he first went to a little nursery at first, but there was nothing wrong with any of the kids there, you know, and he wasn't really happy there. And
he probably found it far too noisy.
I had to go with him. Stay with him. They used to say you'd have to come in with him, you know, and stay.
Sit for the morning.
Yeah.
But anyway. So then on to school.
Then the
and not a lot of help along the way,
No, not really, because they sent him now to a special school, but it wasn't for autism, you know. And he couldn't kind of, you know, he just didn't fit in yet.
Because he was thrown in with a big bunch of people, with special needs.
They all had special needs, but not like Martin's, you know. It's like a specific thing, really, autism.
Of course it is.
And the teaching's different as well.
Yeah. So it probably wasn't doing him much good either,
no,
was it?
No. So, there was no autistic school around where we were, or even, you know, at a distance. But anyway, there was one opened when he was 14, and we tried to get him in there, and we got him in.
So it was a new school, Langate?
Well, it had been a school before, but not for autism, you know.
So they had opened up, opened up a brand new autism unit within the school.
Yeah, yeah. They'd opened it up for autism.
For kids, and Martin happened to be 14 at the time.
Yeah.
So you were able to get him in there?
Got him in there.
So that was good, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we got quite a lot of help then. The teachers were very good.
You must have felt that was the first time you were getting any help, really,
wasn't
it?
Yeah, we did, really, yeah.
You really must have felt isolated?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, because, we did a bit.
Tough?
Yeah.
What were the toughest things?
Well, of course, he didn't understand anything, and we couldn't understand what was wrong.
Yeah.
And then he'd get very agitated, and if something went wrong, if he was out somewhere, or he'd bring that home with him, you know, kind of thing. Because he couldn't tell you, see, that there's something wrong or
no.
what's happened or, you know, because he doesn't understand properly himself.
Very hard time, Norma, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was really.
Really
yeah.
difficult. Yeah. Tricky
yeah.
time.
Yeah, mm. no, it was to do with the communication, really.
Right.
Yeah.
You feel?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah. So how did it sort itself out?
Well, the teachers worked with him about, you see, he didn't even know the difference between dark and light.
Really?
You know.
Explain that to me now.
Well, if you were going somewhere, he'd get up now and we'd get ready to go somewhere, or he'd feel that he should have been going in the morning instead of at night, and so, you know, different things
right.
like that.
So very hard to explain to him yeah, that you had to go somewhere.
He couldn't understand, and he couldn't understand when it went dark in the winter now. You know how it goes dark early?
Early, yeah.
He'd think now he should go to bed at 4 o'clock. You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, I've never thought that, you know, how tricky a kid, an autistic kid might
yeah.
find it. Just the very, because the yeah. winter days are so short.
I know, yeah.
And then the summer days are so
yeah,
long.
Yeah, yeah. Really?
So he'd want to go to bed at about 4, 4:30?
Well, he would if it got dark, he thought it was
nighttime.
Time to go to, yeah.
But then sure, he could be getting up at 3, 4 and 5 in
yeah,
the morning.
Well,
in the summer.
Yeah, well, this is it. In the summer then, he'd be up really early, and it was just completely...
It's all over the place, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, chaos for him, really.
Chaos.
What is 24-hour care, really.
He still is 24-hour care,
really,
isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he is. Since he went to this school when he was 14, and he had a marvellous teacher, absolutely marvellous. He was... He
this is Calvin
from,
Wallace, isn't
yes,
it?
He come from, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely wonderful. I couldn't praise him enough, you know.
What Calvin Wallace recognised in Martin astounded everyone. He discovered that this virtually non-verbal young man could sing.
The teacher would be writing songs out then for him, and they got a karaoke machine. They worked really well with him.
It was you such know. A good time in his life,
yeah,
wasn't it,
was,
that he
yeah.
had someone
and
there
yeah.
who was just able to click
yeah.
in and,
yeah.
and see potential.
Good for us, yeah.
And good for you guys.
Because it really helped us a lot.
How did it?
Well, they brought us into the school and they said, just sit back and watch what we are doing with him. And one of the teachers got married and they asked us if they could take him to the wedding. And he sang at this wedding. So anyway, everybody liked him and everybody there put to send him to a recording studio. So the teacher took him to the recording studio and he made some pop CDs and they sold at the school. They sold so many.
Right.
For autism, you know.
Hmm. This must have been a very exciting time for you and
well,
John.
It was, yeah. And hopeful. I feel since he's been doing the bit of singing, he kind of really got going properly.
I had spoken to Stuart Nielsen on the phone many times and I couldn't wait to head down to Cork to pay him and his Greek wife, Clarissa, a visit.
You're celebrating your 30th anniversary this year, is it?
No, we did already.
Last year,
did
so
already?
Yeah. 31.
Yeah.
31 this year.
Yeah.
So how did you celebrate your 30th? Did you do anything nice?
Oh, we got I got the nicest present. Stuart out broke with tradition, which is never go shopping, ever. Shall I bring it, actually? I'll show you. Hang on a second.
Yeah. So, Stuart, you had to break with tradition last year with the present, Chris.
I'm not great at presents. I'd normally say, what would you like?
Why is that? Shopping a bit of a hassle? Big time.
I want to be sure that it's right.
So he designed me a pendant and he had it made.
Aww.
And this is a silver disc. So it's modelled on the Festos disc in Crete, which was the earliest... Was it the earliest piece of
it's
writing?
It's the earliest piece of printed writing.
The earliest piece of printing writing known. And so it says, I love you 15 times in English and 15 times in Greek.
But there's magic in it.
There's more magic. There's even more magic
because
in it.
Because the layout of the tracks is like a photographic replica of the real Festos disc. So it's a reduced-size replica. The symbols aren't in exactly the same position, but the number of the A side and B side match exactly, so we've got 241 symbols in total, with the right number on each side.
That's
so,
absolutely incredible. Yeah.
And it gave the engraver a very happy, long time.
He was thrilled. It's the largest piece of continuous engraving he's done in his life.
Really?
Yeah, because it's...
What a thoughtful present.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
Was it a total surprise?
Completely, yeah. Oh,
that's absolutely beautiful. It's solid silver.
And there's a bit of a treasure hunt with it. We had to go down and collect it, so I had this as my clue.
So it says, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you, all the way around in a circle, all the way around. And on the other side, in?
In Greek.
In Greek. That's really something special, isn't
it's,
it?
It's wonderful. So this was...
What did you do for Stuart? What did you get Stuart?
I bought him a book. And I bought him a card. I feel a bit guilty about that now. It was two praying mantises saying, after we have sex and before I eat you, will you put up some shelves? I feel a bit bad about it now.
But it's very good. I bet it made him laugh.
You did. Yeah, you kept it, didn't you, somewhere? Yeah.
He still hasn't put up the shelf.
No, my bookcase is still waiting, yes, but still, what can you do?
You have bookcases all over the house.
I know, but they're not enough. They're being stacked on the floor again.
That's very funny. It shows the difference between the two of you guys, doesn't it? It sounds to me that you don't take things too seriously.
No, not really.
No, has that been a good thing to have in this relationship?
Oh, I think so, yeah. And I think that the whole family has a fairly robust sense of humour. Mm. Which helps.
Your family must be well used to Stuart.
Oh yeah, they are, and they're used to me.
Yeah, so they're very used to Stuart's behaviours as well when he's over there.
Yeah, it's they're not considered strange, apart from wearing really thick clothes in the summer. That always gets the Greeks. We turn up in Salonika in July. And Stuart would be wearing a tweed jacket, and it'd be like 35 degrees, and it's night time. My sister goes, please take that off, I'm going to faint just looking at you.
Well, what's that about? You can't, what's that about?
I think that's tactile defensiveness, that this is my uniform, I wear the same thing all year round.
Even if you're hot?
I don't get hot.
Do you not?
I don't think I've ever complained about the heat anywhere.
You like the heat?
You
complain
about the cold, but not the heat.
Yeah.
He feels the cold, but not the heat.
I don't like to have bare skin.
That's a very typical trait, though.
I think so, yes.
It is, yeah. All the children I recorded, they were very much like that. And very much wearing the same clothes all the time. So much so that they grow out of the clothes, they still wouldn't change them. You know, you'd have sleeves up to here. And
yes.
You know, the clothes are getting smaller and smaller, and the child's getting bigger and bigger. And the parents had to think of new strategies just to get new clothes on them.
Chris had cut up my shirts.
Oh, Chris.
To stop me from wearing them.
Tough love.
I started wearing shirts every day now.
But I have shirts in photographs which are 20 years old, 25 years old, that she cut up. And they were the most comfortable because they're worn in.
They're terrible. You can't see the colour at all.
They're now patches and they're going to be a blanket. I've made one wall hanging out of the pockets. So now I have a wall hanging beside my desk and it's all the shirt pockets and you can put pencils in the pockets. 12 pockets on the wall.
Can we see this? Is it here in the house? Yes. Okay.
And, the rest is going to be a blankie for watching.
Did you go after the study?
Not yet.
Okay.
No, we have lots to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've got the slides to look at, and now we've got this amazing shirt.
Well, the slides,
pocket.
All 4,000 of them.
Tell me more about although Chris says you got fed up with the shirts because you just wouldn't take them off them.
Well, I didn't cut them up. I didn't go in a...
It wasn't a psycho rage.
No, it wasn't.
Hollywood movie.
We kind
thing.
Of arranged it that they could become a blanket. And I kept buying new shirts in the hope that these old ones would be donated.
Yeah.
It just got slotted in. Yeah. And the old shirts won. So at some point I said, you know, these are 25, 30 years old, maybe it's time to do something with them.
That's so funny, but Stuart's opinion would be, well, they're lovely and worn in and I'm used to them.
Well, that worked for about 10 years. But.
Yeah. Past their due-by date.
Well past it, yeah.
10 years.
And Talia was a baby when I bought you that flannel shirt.
Yes.
And Talia is?
25 now.
25.
Yeah, well, they were good value shirts.
Oh, very good value.
they were worth their weight in gold.
Yes, so it is very economical.
But it was a good idea then to recycle them. You like that idea, Stuart. Was this your idea?
The house is absolutely full of recycled, reused.
Mm. You don't like throwing things away?
No.
But the shirt thing was a good idea. That would be a great thing for parents to have for younger children or children who just won't let go of something, isn't it? Yeah. Upcycle it into something else.
And I got a Singer sewing machine, the hand cranked on.
Mm.
And it's just wonderful to sit there. I had a sunny day when I was doing it, sewing up squares of fabric, and this thing's going ka-chunk, 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 ka-chunk,
yeah.
One stitch at a time, but so much faster than the hand, but not having the control taken away by an electric motor.
And is this a project that's ongoing? You're doing this now?
I finished the wall hanging, and I haven't started the blanket.
And we've got the patches cut.
I have the patches cut, yes.
And the blanket is for yourself?
It's for watching
house.
TV.
Yeah.
We all have blankets in the living room for cold days.
So this is your house, Stuart. You're here a long time.
Since 1998, so.
18 years.
99. 17 years.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Show me around.
So this is the last bit we did up.
It's a beautiful old... It's a Georgian house, isn't it?
It is. It's built about 1830, 1835. The terrace was completed over that 5 years.
It's beautiful, all the high ceilings. A lot of work restoring this place, isn't it?
Oh, the ceiling's going up there to paint. And
do you do that?
With the platform, yes.
Do you like all that? You don't strike...
I enjoy it, yes.
Do you? You don't strike me as a DIY man at all.
Oh, I did all the woodwork and the new floors and the plastering.
Maybe the repetition and the...
Yeah,
of course. Yeah, that'd be good. And all your books. Of course, you're an avid reader, Stuart.
Yes, so it's all fiction, alphabetical order, and then the ones that don't fit. And then all...
Alphabetical order.
Yeah.
You just can't help yourself at all, can you? That's fantastic. So this is all fiction, you said, and this is all
fact.
Academic?
Yeah.
Fact.
It's... Well, my books are up there, the red ones.
They're all your books.
And these... This is my latest book. I think I told you about this, but you haven't seen it. So.
Oh, no, I don't have this one. Oh, sorry, Painted Lorries. Yeah, I remember reading about it.
This was something... I haven't changed any of the words.
Mm.
And I was very impressed. I didn't make a lot of spelling mistakes
right.
when I wrote it. But I wrote that as my school-leaving English project in 82.
Of course, Painted Lorries was inspired by your life in Pakistan.
Yeah.
The lorries are so decorative that they're not allowed to paint.
The lorries, the men who drive them, they live in them.
Oh.
And their whole life, they're taking their whole life up and down the road.
Yeah, it's amazing.
3,000 miles up and down into Afghanistan. And,
so this is your first non-medical book, non-scientific
yes.
book, isn't it? How did you find that? That's a departure
I
for you.
I found the laying out pictures and trying to make it aesthetic difficult.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a different sort of thought process for you, isn't it?
It is, and trying to make sure that words match an image on the other side. It's very different from saying refer to figure 5 and leaving the reader to...
You're getting all creative, Stuart, that's what it is. It's a beautiful book, it's really lovely. So what age were you when you lived in Pakistan? You were born?
I was born in Egypt.
Egypt.
And then we went to Pakistan from when I was 3 to when I was 7.
7. Do you remember it? You do. Obviously.
Oh yes, yes.
Yeah. Vivid memories.
So I went to primary school there, and then to primary school in Ethiopia.
Right.
And then to boarding school in England.
In
then my parents went back to Pakistan when I was 15.
Right. A very unusual educational route.
Yes,
isn't it
is. And to go to so many schools because every time they moved, change of school.
And that wouldn't have suited you at all, Stuart, really, would it?
It hid things as well because teachers would just think that I'd had a different curriculum and I was moving from a different...
The new boy.
So that explained why I wasn't coping.
Well, it's difficult for children to transition into different schools anyway.
Oh, it's very hard, to keep moving and not have friends because you've left everybody you know behind.
Oh, yeah, that's tough. Yeah. So do you remember school in Pakistan then, your first school?
Mm.
Yeah, what are your memories?
I liked it. It was a huge school. I think it must have had 1,000 pupils.
Mm.
So the primary school was one wing of this massive great college that went up to university entrance level.
Brilliant. Do you remember having any difficulties then?
Not particularly, no.
No? Everything seemed okay? Or do you remember?
No, I was a rapid reader. I was terrible at writing, but I was a rapid reader.
Right.
And they had very rigid ideas about schooling. It was like something from the 1950s. Everybody had their own slate and you did your maths on the slate.
You're kidding.
The teacher would come round and then she would rotate the slate if you'd got everything right and turn it back to you if you hadn't. And
right. And did you show an aptitude for maths way back then?
I've no idea.
Oh, right, right, right. You don't remember school report?
The one thing I remember is flashcards. We didn't have phonics. Mm-hmm. I don't know when phonics came in, but it was whole word recognition. And I used to irritate my father by learning all the words on the back because they were double-sided cards. And he would show me a word and I'd say the word that he was looking at on the other side and I learnt the whole deck.
Really? So you definitely had an aptitude for learning and skills. And
He recognised at least that I could read.
Yeah.
Rather than punishing me.
Oh.
But it used to annoy him.
Right. So you would have been advanced in school then at a young age, wouldn't you?
In some things.
In academia, yeah.
Not everything.
Oh, okay. So then from primary school you went to another school in Ethiopia, you said?
Yes.
How did that happen?
My parents were working in Ethiopia, so.
Your parents were teachers, weren't they?
Yes,
they moved a lot.
Teacher trainers.
Mm-hmm.
So they taught English language teachers.
Okay, so that's why you uplifted and moved.
Yes, every 2-3 years they moved.
Yeah, it's quite disruptive, isn't it? Some families or some kids could really get into that and like it. But did you find it disruptive?
I found it very disruptive, and then going back to England and not having any roots there. And I've always felt rootless, and I see my brothers, and they're settled, and they feel rooted, and I don't.
They have a history there, as such.
I always feel odd and...
Do you, in England?
Foreign, yeah.
Yeah, do you feel at home here in Ireland?
Probably more, because we've lived here longer than I've lived anywhere in my life.
Yeah, yeah, and lived here with your children, so there's a great family base here for you. Okay. What's that noise?
That's the coffee grinder.
Coffee grinder.
Horrible noise. I hate it.
Yeah, you don't like big, loud noises?
I actually love the pantry that we have off the kitchen, because once you're in there, there's no noise from anywhere.
Really?
I mean, it's like being in your own cave, because we're 24 feet below the street at the back, and you're so far from the front of the house, and there's no traffic passing at the front.
Yeah.
And that little bit there, so I love washing up.
Right. Do you just go in there for a little bit of downtime, do the wash, do the dishes?
I go to wash up just to get away from people.
Yeah. Decompress a little bit.
And Chris is saying, why are you using the dishwasher? What do we have a dishwasher for? Why do we have a German slave?
Yeah, no, I can understand that.
What are you looking for? You have a can of music?
Yep. Is this your little space here?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so nice, isn't it?
Piano on the left, photographs, pictures. It's like a little alcove, a little cubby place in the house.
This was horrible when we moved in.
Oh, that's so nice now, Stuart.
A communal shower and a bath that barely fit. And the ceiling was flat, so it was just barely above 6 feet high.
You opened it up, well, there's lovely lights.
And we put the barrel vault in, and a builder put the skylight in.
Yeah.
So we redid all the walls, and the floor had rotted, so we changed the floor.
This is your desk, Malene, on the other side. Is this where you do your schoolwork and your homework? I recognise all the school books from my kids. Lovely light coming in too, isn't there?
Mm.
All your stuff, these all your things here?
Yeah.
Do you want to play something for us, Malina?
Yeah.
Thanks, that'd be lovely. It's a lovely way to spend a Sunday morning. Office.
Yeah, so printers and scanners and things in here.
Your workroom, yeah.
And that's my shirt pockets.
It's so nice. Describe it for me there, guys.
So it's 12 shirt pockets sewn together into a patchwork with a surround of fabric. And you can stand pencils and sharpeners, magnifying glass, rulers.
Scissors.
No, so it's like the engineer's top pocket, but multiplied.
On a wall. I think you need to market this idea. It's a great idea.
I put it on Twitter, and people said, oh, that's a great idea. I must do that with mine.
Yeah.
That's good.
So these were shirts where the collars and the cuffs had worn through, and Chris.
These are the 25-year-old shirts.
Cut them up.
Chris,
you. Yeah, yeah, they are. Yeah, some of them are older, actually.
That one at the top left is older than Thalia.
Yeah.
So that's more than 25 years old.
The top left is a cream shirt.
That was one of my favourites.
Oh, he's getting all sentimental. No. Just looking at terrible, isn't it? That's a great idea, quirky idea. So you managed to hang on to your favourite shirts. They're hanging in your office now.
They're still there.
That's good. That's really good. So what are the other little idiosyncrasies does he have?
There's too many. Socks, not wearing shoes.
Yeah.
As even outside, fixing a puncture outside, in the rain.
And Melina's the same.
And socks.
Yeah. With just socks.
We bring the dirt in on the wet socks. And we've got holes in our socks and feet.
So if you can get away with not wearing shoes, you won't wear shoes?
No.
You just like to feel the surface underneath your feet all the time?
Yeah.
Has that been all your life?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
I can remember being in hospital because when I was about 14, I think.
You hurt your feet?
I cut my feet on gravel, yeah.
Oh.
That was running without shoes.
That was running without shoes.
Well, that was a bit idiotic, wasn't it?
What else?
What was her name? Zola Budd.
That's right.
Yes, yeah, so it was about them.
South African runner. Yeah.
Yeah, but she grew up running without shoes.
So
not
did
like
I.
You.
What else, Carissa?
I think the coat... The coat indoors actually is interesting, isn't it? I
coat
keep
indoors.
Having to remind you that yesterday when we were having a drink, the coat was on the whole time.
Mm.
I didn't want to say anything.
You couldn't take your coat off in a place like that.
But often I'd say, you know, take your coat off. It looks like you're just about to walk out.
Yeah.
But you keep your coat on. It's a sensory
it's
thing.
It's a security thing too, probably, isn't it?
And it's a bit of weight.
The weight,
yeah.
The security. Do you think you mind Stuart then with all these little quirky things he does? Take off your coat,
bit.
Put on
I
shoes?
I do a bit, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably been a bit forceful at times. And you're bossing me around again.
I don't think so. I think she looks after you incredibly well, doesn't she?
Oh, she does, yes.
You have a lovely relationship, you really do. You know, I'd say, I could just imagine you going, take off your coat.
Or a kick under the table when there's some inappropriate humour going
the,
on.
The divots taken out of my shins from making inappropriate comments.
Really?
That's the other thing,
the
yeah.
The divots. Does she know a good sharp kick and where to land?
She does, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm 68. I still don't know what my potential is. Maybe I don't have any. Who cares? It's just me standing before you, just like you, frail and imperfect, struggling. I might say, if this were a 12-step program, hello, my name is David, and I'm a recovering human being. Now, we're here today talking about people who are thirsty for love and hungry for life. And far too many of them find us the only source to quench their thirst and hunger, the family home. And when they leave the front door, they begin to thirst again and hunger again. Why? Because of the poverty within us, ladies and gentlemen. Because of the deep gravity field that we have that leads us to see only their difficulties and challenges. And this is the poverty that permits us only to see disability. There are no amount of documents going to be written by the United Nations that are going to solve that poverty problem. Isn't it important just to be nice to these individuals and human beings who have come to us with sharp edges and who are in the pain of becoming real, just as you and I are in the pain of becoming real? Because the harsh reality in Ireland still today is that you can struggle early on to get what we call a diagnosis. And once you get the diagnosis, you're given a pamphlet and a handshake, and off you go. And you will spend the rest of your child's life trying to scramble for services, supports. And there's a lot of people in this room who will guide you on that journey. But it is a lonely journey, and it is a long and treacherous path. And there are, as Dorothy said, lions and tigers and bears along the way. And you can write 1,000 United Nations documents, and none of them are going to kill the lions and the tigers and the bears. And you can write 100 white papers and put them on a shelf, and none of that is going to help either. Maybe some legislation might help, but we're a long way from that. It's a long journey, isn't it? Eugene O'Neill had this to say. Man is born broken. He lives by mending. The grace of God is glue. It's a lovely, lovely sentiment, isn't it? It's from O'Neill's play, The Great God Brown. I would suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the basic core of your work as parents and educators and therapists and clinicians and psychiatrists or whatever we want to dress ourselves in our borrowed robes in this physical world. More than anything else, you are solderers and welders of the human soul. Your job, as you are doing it, is fusing together the brokenness of yourself and the human beings you care for into a unified whole that is in the process and will always be in the process of becoming real. Becoming real hurts. Kermit the Frog told us it's not easy being green. It isn't easy being green, and it's not easy being any other color. And it's not easy being a human being in this crazy, insane world we live in which we seem to become exquisitely better at suspecting and hating each other. We have a lot of fessing up to do. Do you remember the old Wild West movies? You gotta fess up to a lot, boy. Well, we've some fessing up to do. I think first and foremost, we need to acknowledge the little child inside of us. The one that wants to be loved. The one that wants to be accepted. Not the one that is supposed to be molded into what someone else thinks your potential is. What the hell is this thing, potential? I once saw a cartoon, one panel cartoon, a big auditorium like this, one person sitting in it. And across the back of the auditorium was a big poster, sign, and it said, First National Conference of Children from Functional Families. We're all more human than otherwise. We are all struggling. We are all on a journey to become real, and so are our children. So please remember you are welders of the human spirit and welders of the human soul. And that includes your own, by the way. And remember that there's a little child inside of you that wants from you what it needs, love and acceptance. Every day you should look in the mirror and just say, I forgive you. So today is your day to listen and to learn and to think in your own mind, I don't agree with that or I do agree with that, and to move forward to help your children become more real and to help yourself to become more real and to fight the poverty that lies within all of us, the poverty that makes it possible for us not to love everyone because we are all more basically human than otherwise. Thank you.
The Moon is an Orange Triangle 3 is a Real Films production and was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television license fee.